Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly guide to everything that matters in the technology world. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we ask whether virtual reality is overhyped as Apple's boss promotes augmented reality instead. We meet some teenagers determined to prove that women can prosper in technology, and we hear from an insider why the world is falling out of love with Silicon Valley. With me to talk about all these stories is BBC technology reporter Chris Fox. Hello, Chris.
Hi, everyone.
Good to have you back in the tent again. And my special guest is Madameta Merger, European technology correspondent for the Financial Times. Good to have you here.
Hello, nice to be here.
Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
There are clearly some cool, niche-y kind of things for VR, but it's not profound in my view.
Well, I think the signature move of Silicon Valley is that we think we're more important than we really are.
At the moment, I'd like to work in Formula One, the automotive industry, travel, basically have it all.
All of that coming up. But first this week, how do you like your reality? Virtual or augmented? VR has been hugely hyped over the last couple of years, but the sales of virtual reality headsets have proved rather disappointing. Lately, there's been more focus on augmented reality, AR, where virtual objects are superimposed on the real world. This week, two of the biggest names in tech gave us very different views of which would come out on top. At Oxford University, Apple's Tim Cook was asked by a student to pick one technology which was going to be big in the coming years.
I'm excited about AR because I can see uses for it everywhere. I can see uses for it in education, in consumers, in entertainment, in sports. I can see it in every business that I know anything about. I also like the fact that it doesn't isolate. I don't like our products being used a lot. I like our products amplifying us. And I think AR can help amplify the human connection. I've never been a fan of VR like that because I think it does the opposite. There are clearly some cool, niche-y kind of things for VR, but it's not profound in my view. AR is profound.
Meanwhile, Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg was on stage in California promoting the latest ideas from Oculus, the virtual reality business his firm bought 3 years ago. And guess what? He still believes VR is going to be huge.
We believe that one day, almost everyone is going to use virtual reality to improve how we work, how we play, and how we connect with each other. But we know that the most important technologies don't start off mainstream. Right? In fact, a lot of them seem maybe even too crazy or complex to start. And the conventional thinkers will always say that there's going to be something more familiar, right, that delivers enough of the value. So why build a completely new platform? You know, the reality is, at every step along the way, the future is built by the people who believe it can be better.
Well, that vision has not yet proved quite as exciting to gamers as Mr. Zuckerberg might have hoped. But there is some evidence that businesses are taking up virtual reality as a way of communicating with staff or customers. And Facebook unveiled Oculus Business designed to exploit this market. I went to meet a firm called Immerse, already working with big companies to help them use VR to train workers. And first of all, they gave me a demo. I put on a headset. I've got two controls, which are my hands. I can see my hands in front of me, and I'm in the middle of a desert, and there are the components of a satellite dish, and I'm being helped and instructed how to put it together. So we've now got another component, and I've got to use my hands to turn. I'm very bad at this. Yes. Oh, I think I might have dropped it. Well, let me take the headset off. That was an extraordinarily realistic experience, and talk to Justin Parry from Immerse VR. Justin, there's a real sense that the air has come out of the VR hype bubble, but you're not finding that.
No, not at all. We are actually seeing the opposite. You know, we're a small company, and we're seeing a huge uptake in the number of enterprise-level customers that are interested in scalable approaches to VR.
Why are they convinced that virtual reality is a good way of, I don't know, training people to mount a satellite dish, to run an international courier company, those kind of applications?
Well, I mean, you can do things that are impossible. So you just put together a satellite dish in the middle of a desert. Now, you didn't need to be in the desert, but you did need to have access to that satellite dish, which is £100,000, roughly. And there would be limited training versions of that available. So purely in terms of giving you access to equipment and environments that were previously very, very difficult, VR takes you there.
Now, all the excitement over the last couple of years has been about gaming, really, about this being a whole new revolution in gaming. Has the fact that that has faded, is the danger that that will lessen investment in other areas where you think virtual reality could be more compelling?
Well, I mean, so Facebook yesterday made their announcement at OC4 of the enterprise product. So you have both Vive now and Oculus targeting enterprise. I think that the new wave of headsets will have a big impact on the consumer uptake as well, because we have to bear in mind the Vive and Oculus Rift they're still pretty expensive and they do require a fairly high-end PC. Once that problem goes away and the price bracket comes down, and once we remove the wires from the back of the headset, I think the consumer market will have the take-up.
Tim Cook said this week that VR was going to be a very niche thing. Augmented reality was going to be the big thing. Did he have a point?
No. I think the two can coexist. They have different applications. It's really as simple as that. And they provide different experiences. AR cannot take you to these other places in the same way that VR can. It can't create the same degree of impossible that VR can.
That's Justin Parry from Immerse VR. Madhu Merger from the FT, you're our special guest. What's your take on this? You and I have had tons of press releases over the last two or three years promoting virtual reality. Lots of investment going in. It's not really paying off yet, is it?
No, I think VR is one of those things like Marmite. People kind of absolutely love it or just can't stand it. I'm kind of inclined to agree with Tim Cook. It's always made me feel a bit sick, even though there was all of this kind of hype around how good the technology has gotten, so you don't feel nauseous anymore. And so that's kind of one issue with it. And then the other one, which was already mentioned, is the fact that, you know, you're tethered to a big computer or even a phone, although Oculus is new headset is standalone, and maybe that might be one step towards making it a bit more kind of widely accepted.
And do you think Tim Cook's right that augmented reality is a better bet? I mean, he's obviously putting a lot of money into that.
Well, I mean, I think it's much more accessible to the average person because you've already got your phone and that's something that's already a part of kind of your daily routine. So it's not that much harder to imagine holding it up, which we saw with the whole Pokemon Go craze.
Mark Zuckerberg thinks we lack vision, I think. He says this is the big thinking platform of the future. We ought to broaden our horizons a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting things I've seen in VR are the applications outside of consumer and gaming, like with medicine and particularly like in psychology with PTSD and things like that. I think it can be really, really useful. But I think definitely a lot to prove in terms of making its way into the mainstream.
Time to move on. Although, before we move on, Chris Fox, you are a keen user of all these things.
Well, I was just thinking, with Pokemon Go, the players that I know that still play it turn off the augmented reality part and play it without it, because it's easier to catch the Pokemon if you don't have the AR thing on. And I wonder whether actually AR is a bit overstated as well. Remember with the Wii games console, you could play games by swinging your arms around. Eventually everybody tired of that, because it's much easier to play games by just pushing a few buttons on a controller. And I think we might see the same with AR. It's very cool to swing your phone around, but why would you want to when you could just push a button in an app?
We're being old sticky heads. Chris, it's your turn to give us some of the week's other big tech stories in our tech roundup. More upheaval at Samsung, making lots of money but losing another top boss.
Yes, this time it's the chief executive of Samsung Electronics. That's the part that makes microchips and so on. Kwon Oh-hyun has said the company is in an unprecedented crisis and he wants it to start anew with fresh leadership. Now, this is off the back of what happened in August when the heir apparent to the Samsung Corporation, Lee Jae-yong, was convicted of bribery and corruption. He's appealing against his jail term. But despite all of this, Samsung Electronics is still forecasting record profits this quarter. It says it's been getting higher prices for its memory chips.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Maybe they need to just sack all the bosses and just carry on making huge amounts of money. Google's latest voice-controlled speaker seems to have been listening a bit too closely to its users.
Yes, that's right. A week ago, it revealed the Google Home Mini. That's a small version of its smart home speaker that responds to you when you say, OK, Google.
It also, and we reported on it on this very show.
Yes, and it also starts listening to you if you tap on it. It had a little touch sensor hidden inside. But some reviewers who had an early version of it noticed it was listening more than it was supposed to. It was recording throughout the day and sending conversations back to Google. Very spooky. Google acknowledged that the touch sensor that let you tap it to speak to it was not working properly. It was activating all the time, and so it's disabled it. So no more tap to talk, but you will still be able to say, OK, Google.
Maddie Merger, there's been people all along for the last few years talking about these devices and saying, who'd want a spy in the home? And this is not going to reassure them, is it?
No, it's funny. I saw someone on Twitter said, oh, what a surprise. A listening device is now listening to you all the time. And I really like that because it's like, what else were we expecting?
What did you expect?
Yeah, so...
One more story from you, Chris. From Australia, a battle over whether an unsent text message constitutes a will. What's that about?
That's the story of a 55-year-old man who sadly took his own life, and he'd left an unsent text message in the draft folder on his mobile phone. The message said he wanted to leave everything he had to his brother and nephew, and also talked about some things like money he'd hidden behind the TV and said where he wanted his ashes to be scattered. His wife had argued, perhaps unsurprisingly, that the text message should not be a valid will because it was never sent. But Brisbane Supreme Court ruled the wording of the text message, which included the words, my will, meant the man knew what he was doing, and so it is a valid will. And it's not the first unusual one they've had in Australia. In 2013, a DVD with my will written on it was accepted as a will.
Yet another way in which technology is changing the way we live. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, the teenage girls determined to make it big in tech. Now, Silicon Valley, a place where the future is continually being shaped and where anyone with a good enough idea can come and make their fortune. That, until recently, has been the received wisdom. But now the mood seems to have shifted. It's being described as elitist and out of touch, and scandals over misogyny and bullying have further tarnished its image. Phil Libin is one of Silicon Valley's more thoughtful leaders. He founded Evernote and has now moved on to a startup incubator focused on artificial intelligence. When he popped into the tent, I asked him what had gone wrong in the global capital of tech.
Well, I think the signature move of Silicon Valley is that we think we're more important than we really are, both in our strengths and in our problems. So the advantages have always been overhyped and over-exaggerated, and the problems are being overhyped and over-exaggerated. Truth is, it's actually not that big and important a place in the grand scheme of things.
That seems an extraordinary statement from someone who spent 11 years building great companies and so on in Silicon Valley that's given us the likes of Google, that is home to the world's wealthiest company, Apple. Why is it not that important?
I think there's a lot of amazing innovation in Silicon Valley. There's a lot of great people. There's a lot of great companies. It's still a great place. Those conditions exist in many places in the world. The right question, I think exactly as you said, is, well, why do those conditions come together into making so many important products there and not in other places? You know, I spent time in Mexico City, and Mexico City is extraordinary, right? A much bigger place than Silicon Valley. It's 20 million people in Mexico City. Amazing universities, amazing engineering talent, amazing design talent, amazing product aesthetic, amazing work ethic, like everything is perfect. Well, why haven't there been many important tech products out of Mexico City in the past 10 years? I think the only thing that Silicon Valley does particularly well is we have a great ecosystem for making small companies. And in Mexico City and in most places in the world, they don't. You know, the local lawyers don't really know how to deal with small companies, and the accountants don't, and the bureaucracy is a bit too heavy, and maybe there's more corruption, and investors aren't thinking the same. So we have this talent in Silicon Valley for making small companies, but that's only important because we've arbitrarily declared that the first step to making an important product is go and make a small company. And then we've exported that idea, and somehow we got the whole world to believe that, like, the real thing you have to do is make little companies. And we're trying to do is challenging that notion. We're trying to say, well, what if making little companies isn't the right first step to making an important product? What if you just make important products in other structures? Our theory is that we can have just as much innovation out of Paris and Tokyo and Mexico City and London and everywhere else as you have in Silicon Valley. So that's what we're trying to do.
the culture of Silicon Valley is also coming under all sorts of questions. It's always painted itself as a kind of liberal, but also anti-establishment in a way. And it's being seen as illiberal in its attitudes to women, for one thing, and actually not anti-establishment, but the big new establishment that a lot of people are unhappy with.
There's definitely a lot of cognitive dissonance in Silicon Valley, just like everywhere else. And I think cognitive dissonance is important. Like, this is how society moves forward. So the idea that we have to have conflicting beliefs in our head at the same time, where we are very liberal, and at the same time, we turns out that we haven't been treating gender or underrepresented minorities very well. Like, that friction, that contrast, is how we make progress in the world. So there's definitely a lot of that in San Francisco.
Phil Libin there. Madhu Murja, we were a bit naive about Silicon Valley until recently, weren't we? Politicians especially kind of revered it. We were all supposed to look at it as the way of the future and try to imitate it.
Yeah, I think the kind of big advantage so far for Silicon Valley companies was they were totally unregulated because they were seen as the little upstarts making a place for themselves in a world full of kind of big incumbents. But, you know, that's no longer true. As we all know, the biggest companies are tech companies. And so I think it's only now that regulation is catching up with them. They're becoming like the big oil companies of yore.
And you were writing this week about the tax treatment abroad of some tech companies, particularly in Britain. That's become a huge issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of one of the arms of regulation that I was talking about. So, you know, everybody's kind of starting to realize that they've structured themselves. Obviously, it's legal, but it's these complicated tax structures, which means even though they're making money and have loads of customers here in the UK, everything is being funneled elsewhere, which means, you know, they aren't actually paying as much as a tax as they could be here in Britain. And that's making people more and more angry, I think.
And one of the problems, isn't it, is that they don't see themselves as ordinary business people. They're on a mission to save the world. And yet sometimes they seem so out of touch. Mark Zuckerberg, as part of his virtual reality sort of promotion this week, did a little virtual reality tour of Puerto Rico. Storm hit Puerto Rico in cartoon form. And that really felt out of touch, didn't it?
Yeah, I think he actually even said, "I didn't realise how that would be perceived by third parties," which is like kind of just like a signal of, hey, I don't really know what I look like to the outside world. But it was a little bit tasteless, I think. It wasn't, you know, it didn't come from a bad place, but it was very tone deaf.
A certain amount of growing up to be done by the Silicon Valley tycoons. Now, last Tuesday was Ada Lovelace Day, named after the woman now recognised as the first software programmer. It's an annual celebration of women who've achieved great things in science and technology. But around the world, there's concern that too few girls are seeing a career in tech as an attractive option. Well, this week in London, I found some cause for optimism at a grand venue, Buckingham Palace, where some awards for teenage tech projects were being handed out. We're in a very grand room inside Buckingham Palace. There are chandeliers, there are old masters, and there's a group of excited teenagers who've just been presented with the Teen Tech Awards. And what is striking is that more than half of the winners are girls at a time when there's growing anxiety around the world about getting women into technology. So let's see what's inspired them to get involved. So, Molly, you won the retail award. Your school, Glenamore, won the retail award. What was your idea?
Our idea is a development from Scan to Shop, which is from a supermarket, which you get like a scanner and then you just scan the food instead of waiting by the till. So we've developed that and we've added some features, which is budgeting, product locator, nutrition analogy.
Now, there's a problem out there in this country and in other countries. There's that not enough girls are choosing to go into science and engineering. If you look at the great big technology companies, they've got too few women. Why do you think that is?
Maybe because they're more into, like, makeup, drama, all of those stuff. But maybe if they think of science, they think of more boy type of stuff, like nerdy type stuff, so they don't go for that. They don't know how much opportunities that opens up to them that we found out through these past couple of months.
Rebecca, what's your view? Does science and technology have an image problem for girls?
I don't know. I think there might be, because some girls may be like, oh, this is kind of like a boyish thing, but I don't think it is. That's why I've chosen to do this.
Do you need maybe more role models, famous women who are big in science? Can you name any famous women who are technology role models?
No. So I think there needs to be more as well. So hopefully there will be in the future.
Maybe you'll be one of the famous women in science.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, Lauren Shea is a previous winner of Teen Tech, and it's been a huge inspiration to her because she's been named recently as one of the top under 35-year-olds in engineering and technology when she was just 17. Lauren, you're proof, aren't you, that girls can hack it in technology?
I'd like to think so. I love engineering and STEM, and I think it'd be a shame for girls to be shut away from that industry. I think it is very male-dominated, but we're definitely working on it.
Are you put off when you hear stories of women in Silicon Valley, you know, trying to fight for a role in technology and facing a lot of opposition?
I'm not put off. I'm more inspired, because if another woman can fight for what she believes in, I feel like I can do the same, and it gives me more encouragement to pursue a career in engineering and fight against the odds.
So what's your dream? What kind of job do you want to be doing?
Oh, I have very unrealistic ideas of careers, but at the moment I'd like to work in Formula One, the automotive industry, travel, basically have it all.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Some of the smart young women hoping to make a career in technology. I saw you smiling there, Madame Demerger, a special guest. Still some stereotypical views of what technology is about.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit sad where she's like, oh, maybe they're just interested in makeup. Seems like, you know, the stereotypes have seeped into teens still. But at least, you know, at least they're interested in it. They're there. They're working on it. So hopefully there'll be a generational change by the time they're in the workforce.
Do you think it is changing, though? Because we've just had figures for how many girls go into study computing at school, and it's been a very low level. It seems to be quite a struggle to change that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just look, you talked about role models, and I mean, I'm of the generation in between role models and the girls you were speaking to. And I can name so few women who are role models in the technology world. And I cover this on a daily basis. I think that's the problem. When you don't know who to look to and you don't know what you could be, it's really hard to imagine yourself there. And I think that's a big part of the problem.
Well, you are certainly a role model for people trying to make a career in technology. Thank you very much for joining us this week. We're out of time. Thanks to my special guest, Madame Demerger of the Financial Times. Thanks to Chris Fox from the BBC Technology Empire. You can see all of his videos and stories. He's done a lot of videos this week. He did a video of Tim Cook's speech in Oxford, really interesting, at bbc.com/technology. Tell your friends to download the podcast and join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The Food Chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.